Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 359. Thursday, March 19th, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here. You know, at the very, very beginning of this recording, I said it was March 19th, 2020. Why is it 2020 and not 2020? That famous song by Prince said we're going to party like it's 1999, not like it's 1999 or 1999. Why would I want to say 2020 rather than 2020? I just asked the robot, whose name I will not mention here, and she said that the current year is 2020. What do you say? For some of you, this is the second Sea Realm Vault podcast that you'll be receiving today. And that is because the previous podcast, which was a sort of debrief from my trip to Puerto Rico, I got it uploaded to Patreon, and then I had to leave my home and go do some video work, and I was going to upload to SeaRealm.com when I got home, and I just completely forgot. So thanks very much to Gary, who is the only one to write to me to say, hey, KMO, why no new episodes? Now, for the people who subscribe via Patreon, which I think is a little less than half the audience, they've had a fairly recent episode. But for the old school Sea Realmers, this is the second one you're getting today, although I certainly didn't produce two episodes in one day. So today is day... You know, I'm going to say that last Friday, which is the day that I went to see the movie Parasite here in Bellows Falls, was my last pre-quarantine day. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. This is day six of my self-imposed quarantine. I did accept a ride over to a grocery store over in New Hampshire, which has got a better selection and is slightly cheaper than the grocery store here in Bellows Falls. And that was on Sunday. The shelves were all pretty much fully stocked. The things that seemed thin didn't seem like panic buying. Like, are people panic buying yogurt? But the yogurt selection was pretty thin. But otherwise, I mean, the store looked completely normal. There weren't any more people there than I would expect to see. I did notice, of course, that, you know, the only topic of conversation was the coronavirus or the Wuhan virus, depending on your commitments. I do agree. I mean, you know, generally, I'm not one for excessive political correctness. And anytime anybody is shrieking racism, typically I see it as just their obstinate refusal to talk about economic justice and class. But I do agree that calling this the Chinese virus does direct inappropriate hostility toward people who look Asian. And there have been attacks on American citizens born and raised here whose genes just happen to have originated in Asia. People get stupid when they get scared, which is why my new mission in life is just to remind people that there is a psychological behavior called catastrophizing, making your situation out to be catastrophic when it's really a mixed bag. The portions of our society which are responsible for containing outbreaks like this are learning a lot in this moment, and the rest of us are learning a lot as well. That if you commit a tiny fraction of the resources that you have devoted to preparing for conflicts, armed conflicts with other nations, if you give a tiny fraction of those resources to preparing for an outbreak, well, then you get a tiny fraction of the readiness. Another lesson from very recent days is that, you know, the government's first reaction in terms of remedying the economic fallout from this nationwide self-quarantine was to protect the banks, to protect the wealthy, to make sure that the billionaires remain billionaires, to bail out the cruise lines. But when it comes time to bailing out normal people, people who can't go to work because they are, you know, at home doing what they've been told to do, but they still have bills, they still have rent to pay, they still have car loans to service. I mean, they still have to have money to live, and yet they're not allowed to work. The Republicans in Washington, D.C. are okay with giving everybody, you know, some emergency relief. Remember back after 9/11? Do you remember getting that $500 check? That was from George W. Bush. I am no Republican voter. And I absolutely, you know, do not support the Republicans' whole cloth. But in this instance, the Republicans are willing to help out workers, and Nancy Pelosi is the one who quashed it. What the hell? It seems as though the neoliberal corporate Democratic Party is the party that is committed to harsh discipline for working people and automatic relief for the wealthy. I mean, the 2016 election cycle really laid it on the table, but this one just made it raw. The Democratic Party is the enemy of working people at this point. And while I have spent my entire life identifying myself as being opposed to the Republican Party, at this point, I'm not ready to embrace the Republican Party and say I'm going to be voting Republican from here on out. But the Democrats are my enemy. The Democratic Party is my enemy, and I will treat them as such. Okay, I'm not going to go on in this mode. This podcast will mostly consist of a conversation that I recorded, I think it was on Sunday, with Ed in Montreal. Ed, who you've heard on this podcast fairly recently. We were talking about investing in the markets. Well, the markets have taken a historic beating since that conversation. In fact, they've taken a historic beating since the conversation you're about to hear, given that it's a few days old now. And I honestly don't care at all about the Dow Jones Industrial Average. For a decade or so, the stock markets have basically represented the fortunes, you know, literal and metaphorical, of the wealthy, particularly young people, but even, you know, middle-aged and older workers. Many of them are living paycheck to paycheck. They're working jobs that do not include retirement accounts. They don't have 401ks. They have nothing in the market. And the vicissitudes of the market do not represent fluctuations in their own well-being. They are living on wages, stagnant wages, and few benefits. And it is those people who are hit hardest by this complete stoppage of almost all work, whom Nancy Pelosi sees as being unworthy of receiving any help from the government. I'll say it one more time, and then I will segue into the conversation with Ed. But the Democratic Party in the United States has become, in complete opposition to its own history and self-identifying narrative, the enemy of working people. I advise you to treat them as such. All right, here is my conversation with Ed.
So I went there and they were not playing any music, and I realized it would be hard to speak freely about various and sundry topics with like an audience of Starbucks baristas standing around and my voice echoing in the space. So I decided to come back home.
I've been the person recording the interview in the public space and, you know, my side of the conversation echoing. And sometimes, you know, they were strange conversations to hear just one side of.
Yeah, I realized that we might touch upon some topics on which there's some emotion attached.
I thought it an odd choice that you were going to a Starbucks to record. What was the thinking behind it?
Well, the reason
why is because I've been in for a while and I just wanted to sort of get myself into a different mental attitude by going out.
Let me just start off by saying, hey, I'm talking again with Ed, who I had on the program just recently, but things are moving fast right now. Things have developed recently, and I think a continuation of our previous conversation is in order. First, I just want to say something about isolation. You know, I'm in this situation where I live and work in the same place, and I have a couple of duties that take me out into the world a couple days a week, but for the most part, I spend all day every day alone with my cat and with the AI. And the AI is not much of a conversationalist, neither is the cat. But, you know, at least the cat climbs up onto my lap and purrs and such. So I formulated this plan. I was going to move to Puerto Rico, and I was going to, basically for the amount that I pay in rent here, I could get an apartment plus a membership at a co-working space where I would get up every day and leave my home and go to a place where I would work and there would be other people around, but they're not working on my project, so I don't have to work well with them. I just work in proximity to them. And I got as far as going to San Juan, Puerto Rico, visiting the co-working space that I wanted to use, making some contacts, figuring out if this was really a workable plan. And it really did seem workable. And since I've been back, and this is where, you know, the temptation is to self-aggrandize and say the universe has interposed itself between me and my goal. Basically, events have not, I mean, they've transpired to keep me in my isolation. Not through any deliberate intent, and not that I'm the center of the universe, but I've identified a flaw in my life and taken steps to remedy it. And just, you know, as I'm about to hit the button to set things in motion, suddenly we're all frozen. Like, I just got word this morning that there's a curfew now in San Juan, Puerto Rico, that all businesses have to close early in the evening, and it's going to be a hard play to get Puerto Ricans to not hang out and drink with one another every night, as it seems to be, you know, the recreation of choice there, at least as far as I could tell. Anyway, that's just my frustration and my framing everything around me being the center of the universe.
I hear you and I feel you. And, you know, I think the geometry of reality is probably not as linear as our simian minds, as our simian brains have adapted us to perceive it as. So who knows? I don't fully understand why these funky coincidences and synchronicities happen, but it's quite a ride.
It is.
Somebody asked why Italy and Iran in particular have very high rates of infection. And so one of the hypotheses is, for one, in Iran, the whole going to the mosque every Friday and being tightly packed in, and Italians being very physical in their how they greet each other and how they stand close to each other and talk and wave their arms. And so I think that there are particular social habits that are either promotive or preventative for the spreading of disease. So perhaps Puerto Ricans have some of those more Latin passionate ways of congregating with each other.
They are a passionate bunch, to be sure. I talked to my mother this morning, and she told me she was going to church. I'm like, Mom, come on. What are you doing going to church? Why?
I take it she's of the boomer generation.
She's the generation before the boomers. Silent generation?
Silent generation, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I noticed the Gen Xers too kind of get ignored. I follow Reddit threads, and there was just one this morning talking simply about that a lot of boomers are like shrugging it off, like not taking the risk, the personal risk that they're under. They were talking about Gen Zs and millennials and boomers, but no, it was like only deep into the thread that people recognize the existence of us Gen Xers.
As always. Yes, it is only we Gen Xers who can imagine that, you know, the world revolves around us, because everybody else has trouble remembering we exist.
Which is in some ways part of our plight, because demographics play a big role in how well the economy is. Like, if there's a bump of youthfulness, it tends to generate a lot of economic activity as those youth people move out into the world. So apparently, what I understand from our generation is a lot of us graduated into a recession. There was a recession in the early 90s. And it was particularly acute here in Quebec, because the talk of independence of Quebec was ramping up. And that made the recession more acute. So I noticed millennials, on the other hand, seem to have graduated more into a boom. And I do think that's largely associated with demographics. The more people there are, the more transacting is happening, and thus the more career opportunities there are.
And now my kids are Zoomers, or Generation Z, and they're graduating into, you know, the next iteration of the downturn.
Uh-huh. Well, your oldest son's already graduating, is he?
He's in college.
As is my daughter. She's celebrating her 18th birthday tomorrow, which is adult age here. So I had made a reservation at the casino. I thought, what adult things can we do together that you couldn't do yesterday? But they closed down the casinos here. So we're going to have to think of something else to do. We'll probably do a Zoom chat for her birthday.
Well, you could each go to the roof of whatever building you're in and just throw fistfuls of, you know, money out into the wind. You might not be able to get rid of it as quickly as you could at the casino, but, you know, it's right. The same sort of thing.
I hear you. Yeah, maybe not a good adulting lesson for her, but I wanted to do something special.
So the last time we talked about trading and trading on volatility.
The VIX, the volatility index.
Yeah, well, that's one aspect, you know, of the conversation, but there seems to be some volatility going on right now. So is anything from our previous conversation, is it conveniently illustrated by the news of the day?
Very much so. So the volatility index, it's a fascinating number, and it's a fascinating chart because it measures the degree to which there is fear in the stock market, and it's also a measure of how much the price changes, house versus just incrementally. If prices are only changing in small increments, the VIX will be low. But if prices are changing wildly, the VIX will be very high. And right now, the VIX, and usually when the VIX spikes up, let's say when Iran threw missiles at the air base in Baghdad, so the VIX spiked up for one day, and then the U.S. retaliated, and it was over. World War III did not start, so the VIX came down. Everybody calmed down. But this is a very unique case. Now, the VIX is at almost breaking a record. It's more like a thermometer. People call it the fear index, and that's like a pretty good thumbnail for it. And it's at the second highest it's ever been since this index was created in the early 90s. And it's very possible that we will reach that height from late 2008. And there's
pandemic
actually...
Pandemic is young.
Pardon me?
I said the pandemic is young.
Yeah, that's... And also 2000... That's when I first started listening to the C-Rome podcast, too.
2008?
Yes.
Time to tune in.
Yes, the pandemic is young. So that's my model, is that that's sort of the question as a trader, is how ahead of the pandemic is the market? Because markets are always forward-looking. But so how much of the future badness is already priced in? So there are some people who say, well, the prices the current prices factor in how bad it's going to be in 3 weeks. And other people say, no, there's still levels of denial. Like people with 401ks haven't called their broker to tell them to withdraw, because a lot of people have been indoctrinated in the idea of stay in it for the long haul. Don't sell
low. Do you think people should be cashing out their 401ks?
I don't think so. I think one of the things is how much time do you have left? So like if you're 75 and you don't know how much more time, like 5 years might be, like the market might not recover in 5 years. If you're 50, then you've got like a good 30 years. So the market will be recovered in 30 years. But the time to cash out would have been 2 weeks ago, like when this started, I think. But it would depend how old you are. Like if I'm going to need the money over the next 5 years, then you maybe should have considered cashing out a week ago. But, you know, it's a really hard call to make, but it's all about, when are you going to need the money? And the better thing to do is to leave it in longer. And even if you can start acquiring at this point, because this is not like the end of the world, as it probably isn't. It's probably like more similar to the 2008 financial crisis in terms of the effect on the stock market. So you can see here how in the 2008 things started to return to normal in March. And for anybody who shorts the VIX, because you don't have to go long, like shorting means taking a position that benefits from the underlying instrument declining. So there will be, once we enter this phase in the VIX, which is like December 2008, January 2009, people who short the VIX will be able to take profits if things play out just like they did back in 2008, 2009. So that's what I'm looking forward to as a trader.
So I have this opinion. I'm not wedded to it, but so far nobody has said anything to, you know, divorce me from it. And that is that short selling seems remarkably similar to fraud to me. You know, it seems like you're selling something that you don't have.
Mm-hmm. Let's say I always have a hard time explaining short selling, but I think the price of peanut butter is going to go down. I will go and borrow a box of a dozen jars of peanut butter, and I'll pay, let's say, $2. I'll board at a rate of $2 each. So I have to promise to give the person who lent me the peanut butter 12 cases back. So then I borrow the peanut butter from him, and then I go sell it on the open market for $2 each. So I collect $24. Then a week later, the price of peanut butter has gone down to $1. So then I can buy the peanut butter back on the open market for just $12. So now I've got my case of peanut butter back, and then I return it to the person who lent it to me. So he's got his peanut butter back, and I've cashed in $12. So that is that's my basic explanation of what short selling is. You borrow it and you sell it at the current high price. The price comes down, and then you buy it back, and then you return the thing that you borrowed to the person who lent it to you.
What you've just described sounds like fraud to me. You're selling something you don't own.
Okay. but what I do it with is options. So it's more like selling insurance contracts. So options are calls and puts, and a put is an insurance contract. You're saying, like, I promise that you can put this thing to me at this guaranteed price. And you'll, let's say if you're a store owner and you've got a warehouse full of peanut butter and you're afraid that the price will drop too far, I will sell you a put, which is like an insurance contract guaranteeing that you'll be able to get at least $1.75 for it. I'll sell you a put contract. So in a way, what you're doing is by being a seller of options contracts, you're helping to facilitate more confident transactions, because people have guarantees of certain prices, which allows them to sort of, they're offloading the risk of drastic price changes to you, and you're hoping that there are no drastic price changes and that they'll never collect on the premium that you're selling them. So as an options contract seller, you're basically the insurance company, and so in that sense it's not fraud. You're actually reducing risk, making it easier for people to transact. So in that way, I don't see it as fraud, because options contracts are different from short selling stock. So short selling stock is more the peanut butter example, and being involved in the options market is more like being involved in the insurance market. And I know you're in insurance, so...
I used to be.
Yeah.
It's not a... It's not an arena where, you know, a lot of value is placed on ethical behavior.
Right. But I think the reason why people can commute to work every day and we have like highway systems that actually function is because people know that, you know, should there be accidents, the harm from those accidents will be mitigated by the insurance. So in that sense, I don't feel it's unethical to do it using options contracts. And also personally, my ethics are more related to human beings, like individual human beings. I don't feel pangs of remorse if I do questionable things that affect very large organizations that can easily absorb, you know, the minor harm that I might be causing them.
Right. Hey, we've been looking at this S&P volatility index. Let's just look at the regular S&P index. Let's just see what it's done.
This is the same thing as the S&P. It's a it's an ETF that mirrors the S&P. It's an exchange traded fund that you can actually buy and sell just like a stock, called the SPY, and you just have to add a zero to get the S&P 500. So here it's currently at 270. So that means the S&P 500 is at 2,700.
So go out to like a year.
Okay.
Because in this, you know, very close up view, yeah, it looks like it's falling precipitously.
But the last time we had a serious drop was in Christmas 2018. Mm-hmm. And it got down to 2,350. So we still have a ways to go to reach there, right? We had a little bump.
And it rebounded pretty consistently and, you know, maintained its upward trajectory thereafter.
Yeah, the financial world has its own jargon. And one of them that I learned is called jawboning. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that term?
To me, that's talking.
So jawboning, it means when the public figures, like the chairman of the Federal Reserve or the Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin, they get out in front of the cameras and they say things. They just say words, like they make promises about the future or future action. And just saying those things or making those declarations causes a shift in market sentiment. And that's what actually happened in December 2018. So things started getting shaky in October 18, and then November 2018, and then December. And then right at this point, there was some coordinated effort with the Federal Reserve and Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. And they said, we are now open to reducing interest rates to the Federal Reserve interest rate. And once he declared the openness to that, that caused things to turn around. And so the market was very sensitive to that sort of jawboning. And apparently one of the things that turned around here was in recent days is the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 0.5%, which is very large. When they reduce or when they adjust interest rates, they do it by 0.25%. So by doing 0.5%, it sort of telegraphed desperation. The market continued to fall. So that it had the opposite effect, because the market interpreted that as being the Federal Reserve has lost control. And then that caused things to plunge even more. So one of the reasons for the fall is that the market seemed to have lost confidence in the executive branch and the Federal Reserve to really get a handle on this situation, with the exception of Friday afternoon when Trump got in front of the cameras and said some things about, he said that things are going really, really well. He declared a national emergency, and he had the pharmacy industry people behind him and saying that they're going to do really, really, really great things. So that caused a spike in the afternoon on Friday. So what happens is the futures markets open on Sunday at 6 p.m. So all the traders like get in front of their computers and start tweeting on Twitter about what's going to happen. It'll be 5 hours from now. So that's when we start to see if the Friday bounce from the national emergency stuck, or if it was just, because what usually happens is when they get in front of the cameras and say those things, there's usually a temporary pop. Because now there's also high frequency trading. So there are algorithms, there's computer algorithms that will immediately digest text that gets released. They'll scan it mechanically, and within seconds, they'll start to make trading decisions. And you'll see pops instantly once announcements get released. And that's not because of human beings trading. It's because of these supercomputers that are given license by these large financial firms to trade on their behalf.
Would you scroll back over to the left so we can see more of the history?
My pleasure. So, okay. Yeah, we could easily test the December 2018 low.
Well, let's pause for a second.
Okay.
So, since you directed me to the ZipTrader channel on YouTube, I've watched many of his videos, and they are entertaining, I have to say. You know, I've been looking into the possibility of swing trading.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading about it, like I went to Investopedia and I started reading about it, and they say, yeah, swing traders, you know, they're looking to buy in and hold a position for a matter of days or weeks or a couple months at most. And if you go beyond that, you're not swing trading anymore. You're just investing.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that swing traders, they don't care about the underlying value of the company or the prospects of the company. They don't care really what the company sells. All they care about is the pattern of ups and downs that it's displaying over the short term. And, you know, this is called technical analysis.
Yes.
And if I were just to take a, you know, technical analysis viewpoint of this image that we're looking at, I would say that, yeah, I'm sure at every one of these deep dips at the very bottom, some public figure said some pretty nonsense and maybe somebody took, you know, they took comfort in it and started buying. But I don't care about that nonsense that they said. I just look at this, you know, this history, and I see that every time there is a steep decline, that it bounces back. I mean, there's no trough where you're just down in the bottom and just staying low for a while. It's, you know, it's like an impact point where there's a bounce. And I don't really care what was said at the bounce or what people were thinking. I just know that every time you see one of these valleys on the downside, you know, when it's trending steeply down, lots of people are panic selling and they're losing money, but you can't sell without a buyer. You know, for every share sold in panic, somebody who isn't panicking bought it.
And they call that the counterparty.
Right. Well, the counterparties do really well, you know, in these times of panic because they're getting assets on the cheap. And the history of the market, as demonstrated in all these graphs, demonstrates that, you know, after these panic troughs, not troughs, but, you know, these panic downward peaks, the upward climb starts again. And the people who weren't panicking made money off the people who panicked.
That is a very interesting conclusion. And you might notice that the chart we're looking at stops in 2013. So we've actually, the last recession ended, I'm going to say 2010. So we've had a bull run, a 10-year bull run. But there are periods where this pattern, which we call positive drift, things tending to drift upwards, positive drift. There are periods where that does not hold. And one of them, you were around at that time, is the dot-com crash, the dot-com bubble, which happened starting in it started to collapse at around the year 2000. So we get this period here from, it peaked at around September 2000, and the market didn't return to the September 2000 levels until like 2007. So the top of, if you look at this period here, you're not seeing really that same pattern. So from 2000 to 2007. So the dot-com bubble popped in late 2000, and we didn't get back to where we were until November 2006. So, but you do see that positive drift starting to happen again in the beginning of 2003. So all this to say is like the past 10 years have been a bull market, but there are periods of bear markets that can last a while, such as this one that I'm showing you here.
So what do you think? I think we're headed for another one of these long periods of slow growth, or do you think we're going to get back to just the crazy growth we've seen recently, which we've come to think of as normal?
Okay. What, in my opinion, what's going to happen is a recession will be triggered. I think there's a cyclicality to recessions where economic activity recedes, regresses. There's less employment, and because of the less employment, there's less buying and selling, and because of the less buying and selling, there's less employment. And it's a negative feedback loop that feeds on itself. And they've been pushing that off. It looks like it's wanted to happen because of something called the yield curve inversion. So there's this thing called the yield curve inversion that is a harbinger of a recession. And that first happened a year ago. And so that set people's alarm bells off. So people have been expecting a recession, were due, because one tends to happen every 10 years, very roughly. So the last one was 2008, 2009. So I think what's going to happen is this triggers a recession also. So we still need to cover from that. So I think we are like heading towards a bottom, but I'm not seeing a dramatic recovery, because I think once this coronavirus thing fades, there's a good possibility of a recession. But recessions, you know, they last at the most 3 years, 2 years, 3 years. At the same time, it could be more like the metaphor of a forest fire or a pruning of a tree, where like right now in Australia, that a lot of the vegetation there is coming back gangbusters after the summer fires. So it's also very possible, you know, that the recession doesn't happen, that there's a huge amount of pent-up demand once all the dust settles and that the economy takes off. So there's those two points of view. And both of them, I think, are, you know, have basis in reason.
In periods when the stock market keeps climbing to new highs, and we're used to hearing, you know, week after week that a new high has been hit, it's quite tempting, and one does hear that, you know, the opinion that the market is, the whole market, everything is overvalued and overbought.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's the case? And if so, this recent plunge, do you think this has brought us below the level of the actual value of the various commodities that are, you know, represented on this graph, or do you think it's still overvalued?
I think a lot of it was overvalued, and what I would say is, like, I'm very long on technology companies like Zoom. So, like, I think one of the things that's going to shake up from this, I think people are going to adopt more the virtual and the digital. Because I do really think that, like, a lot of business travel, for example, is really unnecessary. Like,
I agree.
And it's very consumptive. You know, why do you need to, like, hotel room, burning all that fuel? Like, these platforms are very rich in terms of the, like, I'm sharing you this graph and we're looking at each other, listening to each other. So I think people will get out of that habit more of the physical, and, like, more and more using the digital. So I think the technology companies like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Zoom, I think they'll recover quickly, but not so much airline companies or, like, the real physical economy. And I think that's a good thing in some ways, like, because we put a lot of stress on the environment by our consumption of matter and energy to get what we want done. And a lot of that isn't necessary. I've seen a trend, which I don't know if I coined it, but I call it the etherealization of the economy. Like,
I've heard other people talk about the ephemeralization of the economy.
Okay. So like, you know, people selling digital objects in World of Warcraft and, like, making a career out of designing ships in EVE Online, or being able to walk into an Amazon store and just having it recognize you from the signal coming off of your phone and being able to pick things off the shelf and just walk out. And it's all very invisible. And I kind of like that. So I think that is one of the cultural changes that may be happening. Like, even the schools, like my daughter's school has been canceled provisionally until March 30th, but it may be even more. But they're all talking about doing e-learning. And that's what's been happening in China, is one of the reasons that China has been able to sort of withstand this is because much of their economy has gone digital. I know in South Korea, they're having drive-through testing centers, and you get the results texted to you the next day, so you don't actually have to physically go back with all your virus shedding to get the result. They'll just text it to you. And similarly in China, like a huge amount of the diagnosis is happening through remote systems. So I think that will be one of the ways that will change. So rather than it being, rather than working from home being a smaller percentage and something that is exceptional, it'll be more, much more common for companies to offer that.
And I think a lot of people, particularly men, particularly middle-aged men, are going to discover that going to work every day, while really completely unnecessary in terms of completing the task they have been assigned, provides them with human contact, which they will sorely miss if they're just working from home all the time.
Well, there's a business opportunity for you. How can we provide that human contact to all those stay-at-home workers? I think there's a future in LARPing. But it's another reason why I approve of moving to Puerto Rico, and that why my plans are to move to Taiwan, because of the blue zones. Like, it's good to live in a place where you are nudged into human contact and physical activity, where the, you know, the way that the physical environment is set up and the social environment is set up is that you're pushed towards physical activity and human contact.
What is a blue zone?
A blue zone is an area of the world where studies show that the elderly are very healthy, healthy and happy, very high rates of not being diseased, longevity, happiness. And there are six that have been identified in the people who promote this idea. One is in somewhere in Southern California. Another is Okinawa, Japan. There's another in Italy, Sardinia, Italy. There's a place in Greece, and there's a couple, one or two more. And they find they all have common attributes. And people continue working when they're old. So they have a sense of purpose. Like, they show, one of the is the 80-year-old taxi driver in Okinawa, who still feels that he has a social function. And every day he gets out and he's with people and they are grateful for his service. The other one is just like natural physical activity, not necessarily exercise, but just in going about your day, you're moving, going to get vegetables or walking to work. And the other one is interpersonal social contact. So like when I was in Mexico, in Oaxaca last year, like I saw lots of older people preparing for their annual Gulguzeta, I think they call it. It's like a cultural festival that they have every July, and it involves preparing dances, public dancing, and performances. And so that there's a lot of social contact in that sense. And I think I think we both suffer from one of the symptoms or one of the attributes of, I like to think of it as late stage capitalism, which is alienation. And it's interesting because I know that conservatives under Reagan, like one of the reasons they opposed liberalism was that families, like a nursing home is the commodification of elder care, and a daycare center is the commodification of child care. When I lived in China, like, and it's still the case, like the parents of the husband move in with the couple and then take care of the children. And then they enjoy meals together at nighttime. And so I really don't think the commodification of every human activity is a good thing. And one of the effects is social alienation, because we don't need each other. We need each other less because we are buying human needs as commodified services, such as, you know, nursing home care or daycare for little children.
As Charles Eisenstein used to say, we are dependent on the labor of strangers. And really, we have purchased the labor of people that we don't meet, although we are still dependent on it. But I think everybody's needs are much better satisfied if, you know, we are dependent upon people with whom we are physically proximate, you know, people who are right there with us, like people living in your house. And a lot of the times when people are, and, you know, this is part of Andrew Yang's big message, is that, you know, a lot of times the most valuable thing that a person can do isn't valued very highly by the market. So, for example, his wife staying home with their special needs son, that's the best use of her time, really. But it's not recognized, you know, as something which should be compensated financially. But it needs to be, because everybody, you know, everybody's got to pay rent, everybody's got to eat.
Mm-hmm. And there are examples of people I saw. I remember seeing a woman crying after she was shown, like, she goes to work every day, her husband goes to work every day, and they calculated how much it costs for them to do daycare and the second car and the gasoline. And they said, well, you'd be better off if one of you didn't work, and instead of like paying for these services that enable you to work, like, in net, it's better if just one of you works. But unfortunately, due to rent seeking, that's impossible for a lot of us. I mean, those who seek rents from us.
So what is, you know, to the degree you're willing to share in public, what is your strategy for continuing your activity as a trader through the course of the coronavirus lockdown?
Oh, okay. So I actually have shorts on the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, because I think that there is a gap between the reality of what's coming. And the reality of what's coming is foreshadowed in what's happening in Italy. Italy's like 9 days ahead of us here in North America. Plus,
you think we've done everything as poorly as the Italians have?
Yes, except they were nice to the Chinese, so now the Chinese are helping them. I don't think we can expect plane loads of Chinese medical workers to come and share their experience. Well, maybe they will. No, they're angry at Canada too for what we did to the CFO of Huawei.
Yep.
Because she's now in house arrest in Vancouver. What I'm trying to say, so Italy is like our best model, because you have to use something to make a prediction. So, you know, it's going to get worse in terms of headlines and news stories. And I don't think the market has quite catched up to what's, you know, the worseness, and also the poor management of the executive branch of the United States government. I think there's more to fall in the stock market in the very short term, over the next few weeks. In other words, I'm saying I don't think we've hit the bottom yet, because the market hasn't fully fathomed how bad it's going to get. And I think that's part of, like, it's not just American, like we have it too in Canadian. When bad things happen, it's always over there. Like, there bad things happen once in a while, but then it's over. But bad things, really bad things, happen to other people elsewhere. Like, we're protected by our oceans. But we're not used to things getting really bad over here. And I don't think it's apocalyptic, but it's going, you know, it's going to continue to be more a la Italy model. So I'm expecting things to continue, the markets to continue to decline, as we've seen for a few more weeks. I don't think the bottom is in. So I'm trying to profit. Take little profits from the bottom, but I'm not putting my whole stake on it, just to benefit from that. And then I'm waiting for things to settle down. And because the VIX is so elevated right now, as we take that journey down the slope of things settling down, I will be continually shorting the VIX via two particular exchange-traded products, UVXY and VXX. So I'll be doing strategies in the options market that benefit from those things going down, because I'm very confident that the heights that the VIX is at now are temporary. So once I feel that top is really in, and I don't need to call the top, it's okay to start once things start declining. I will just start, my intention is to benefit from that decline by shorting via options UVXY and VXX. And in the short term, over these next 3 to 4 weeks, I'm going to try to personally benefit from the decline in the market. I'm wondering if that Does it? I always feel, because like I'm conscious of criticism of other people, I do feel like avaricious, like this quality of money.
Profiting from a downturn?
Yes, it feels, I actually don't feel guilty about it, but I feel afraid that other people will look down upon me. In a way, it is a sign of, had I generated wealth via externalizing my true value, which is interior, like skills and talents of which I'm well graced with, then I wouldn't need to be doing this. So I do feel a little bit of shame about it, but at the same time, because we all need money and we all generally want money, I think there's something very honest about being transparent, like just seeking money in and of itself. For example, like when you go to let's say somebody goes for a job interview to a call center, they have to bullshit their way through a lot of those job interviews by saying, well, I'm really looking forward to the challenge of dealing with making sure that our customer base is satisfied. Like you have to, but really what you want is the frigging paycheck, you know?
Exactly.
So at least I'm getting rid of, at least with this trading, it's like I'm being fully on, like I just want the money. But also, and the other part of it is like, it's like playing bridge or learning Sudoku or crossword puzzles for these aging brains. Like I'm 51, so I think about that. I enjoy the mental exercise, puzzling over these matters.
I don't so much. I don't do Sudoku. I don't do crosswords. What was the other thing you mentioned?
Sudoku, crossword puzzles. Other people play chess and mahjong, bridge, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. So this is like a form of that. You're exercising those mental muscles by studying those charts and talking about V-bottom dips. And
yeah, I was planning to fight off the, you know, the mental deterioration by learning Spanish.
Well, there you go. I will be learning classical Chinese characters in Taiwan.
For the rest of your life, most likely.
Yeah, yeah.
There are my daughter. Of them.
Pardon me? Oh, yeah, the thousands of them, sure. Yeah, Chinese poetry is an ocean of richness there. And that's actually, there's a model for what you do once you're in your golden years in China and Japan. And one of them is honing your Chinese calligraphy skills. So that's something that I studied, I don't know if you know about that, but I studied Mandarin Chinese at university and I lived a few years in China studying Chinese. So it's something that I'm looking forward to continuing to pursue.
In Taiwan.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I prefer Taiwan. Taiwan is very close to the blue zone of Okinawa. So that's another reason why I've chosen it. It seems very blue to me. It's the kind of place I'd like to spend my later years.
Well, on the topic of, I don't feel guilty, but I do feel self-conscious about deliberately trying to make money off of, a crisis. My message that I'm trying to articulate without going overboard, you know, and without being a monomaniac about it, is that really it is the fear that is causing the damage. That's less true now that, you know, social distancing is seen as an actually effective way to halt the virus spread. But before that, you know, the markets were falling anyway. People were panicking. People are still buying up huge amounts of toilet paper. I don't really understand that particular urge.
I can offer an insight.
Go ahead.
The virus is a thing that our disgust reaction gets triggered by it. Toilet paper is used to get something that is germ infested away from our bodies, a disease inducing substance.
Gotcha.
We use, and so we make that, we hear virus, toilet paper, it just clicks the right buttons for people.
Because I've, you know, got some experience with fasting and also travel and basically, any interruption to my regular routine results in a sudden lack of need for toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when I'm fasting, you know, if there's no point in having more toilet paper on hand than you have food in your bunker. as soon as you stop eating, the need for the toilet paper goes away.
Sure. And I've been in a household where they used rags and they would just wash them like diapers. Some of the hippie friends that I've had in the past.
Yeah. The Hare Krishnas do something similar. I stayed with them briefly in my youth. They provide toilet paper to visitors to their temple, but the people who are living there full time, they have just a little plastic cup of water next to the toilet.
Oh, sure. That we had that one in India too. And they would, the Indian people that we were with would talk about the virtues of doing it that way versus toilet paper. So there's many other options beside that. One thing I did know, I was quite fascinated by, because I started to prepare about 10 days ago. I just started to acquire things like pasta and hand sanitizer, because like I was following what was happening in Italy and Iran, and I knew the tsunami was coming our way. But it was relatively easy to get hand sanitizer like 8 days ago. They were out of face masks. But then when I went back to the grocery store on Thursday, that's when I saw my first sense of alarm and tension in the store. There was a few people who were like every man for himself type attitude. And like things didn't crack, but you could see it in a few people like racing around with their carts, and there were no bananas left. So it was interesting to see the switch like this in the public consciousness. Even though all the information was there beforehand, it seemed to me when the important person got on the TV and said that this is serious, like that's what caused the flip. It's not like there were other sources of information that could have like telegraphed, let you know it's time to start preparing. But it was when the guy with the title got on the TV and started talking that people really change their attitude. So it outlined to me how much herd mentality there is out there. And I heard a term called infovore on Twitter, like people who are voraciously consuming information.
Yeah.
And I realized, though, I do have that advantage over the masses.
You know, we live in different countries, but we live close enough to one another that we listen to the same NPR station.
True.
So even though you're not an American citizen, you won't be voting in the election, still it affects your life. And I know you're more aware of it than I am of, say, Canadian politics.
True.
How do you see, what do you see going on? I mean, what are the dynamics that interest you in terms of the primary election, the upcoming general election, and the virus and responses to it?
There's a real kind of poetic justice in the virus problem that is being confronting the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself, because he, for me, is all about the salesman's trick, like the razzle-dazzle, like trying to set the narrative by being very insistent with what his words are. Like he's not concerned about reality itself. He's concerned about setting the narrative. This is all my opinion, of course. So like the traditional con man, razzle-dazzling the public with his impressive words, or the convincing salesman saying that my enemies are wrong, my enemies are lying to you, my enemies are hoaxing, and they're the ones that are at fault, they're just attacking me. Reality is the way I say it is. And for a lot of unconfirmable realities, that never gets tested. But this is undeniable, what's here and what's coming. Like, you know, when people in nursing homes start being taken off to ICU wards en masse, like you can't just brush that off. So it's a real sort of comeuppance, and it's a real challenge to his political technique of trying to set the narrative by just pounding the table and being insistent, or calling something a hoax if it makes him look bad. So that sort of technique is really stretched to the limit with this. So I think it has the possibility of really exposing the vacuity of his management skills in that sense. And concerning the primaries, who do you want to be the leader? So is it the person whose policies you agree with the most, whose policies you think would be best, who you like personally the most? But the other question is like, who can best unite the country? So because of the problem of polarization right now, I'm very partial to Bernie's policies, but at the same time, I think it would just continue the polarization. So like, I would be more inclined for a competent centrist, even though my politics aren't in line with theirs. Like, I'm more on the left side, not extreme left, but, you know, I'm sort of a Canadian liberal left of center type person. But I more favor leftist policies because I think they are for the people more. But I would be concerned that if Bernie becomes president, it just continues the tension in the country. And a centrist like Pete Buttigieg, although he's, you know, or Kamala Harris, like, I don't like the corporate Democrats, but somebody who has the power to have like a more of a big tent type politics that can bring in the right wingers that are not too far to the right. That's what I would prefer as a prescription for your country, but that's not necessarily who I would want, but I want your country to be healed, you know, as much as possible.
Well, those potentially centrist, competent managers all dropped out to back Joe Biden.
Yes, and it makes me very sad because he is obviously suffering from dementia, like early stages of, you know, which comes of a lot. I heard a lot of it comes from hard drinking, so a life of, as if you drank a lot. So I wonder if it has something to do with alcohol consumption. But he's having trouble stringing together sentences. But to me, that's not so much of a concern as long as you have a competent cabinet. And we don't really need a lot of these. It can be a figurehead if you have a competent structure around you to manage the different departments. But I don't think he's got what it takes.
To do what?
To beat Trump in an election.
Oh, no.
But what I also think is that the no to Trump vote can be, the anybody but Trump vote might be big enough to defeat Trump. So I'm not saying that Biden, it would be anybody, but like, I think there might be enough of a motivated electorate who is like the guy who isn't Trump, like not necessarily positively choosing Biden or Sanders, but he might have motivated enough voters to that degree.
We'll see. I don't like the guy, but at the same time, I'm certainly not going to, you know, send any sort of message to the Democratic Party saying, you know, you can do whatever you want to me and to working people, and we'll still support you because Trump is bad. I absolutely will not send that message.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing, like, I know this is extreme, but like, I wouldn't mind seeing, like, for me, there's functioning areas of the country. I think, like, once a country gets like really, really big, it's like there are not enough unifying factors to make it really a viable political entity. And like, for me, California is a functioning society where there can be enough consensus that things go, but things seem so, it seems like rural America and the coastal elite cities, they're like almost like occupying different universes. And it seems less and less viable that they want to have a political consensus for moving forward.
Well, I imagine if you were to spend a few days in Los Angeles talking to people and then take Amtrak up to San Francisco and spend a few days talking to people there and then rent a car and drive like 3 hours north along the coast and talk to people there, you might not be convinced that, you know, as convinced as you are now, that California is any sort of cohesive whole.
Okay.
I think people in the San Francisco Bay Area are genuinely afraid of the people who live in Northern California, because, you know, the people living in Northern California, for them, they might as well be people from Oregon or, you know, like Eastern Oregon or Idaho or Montana. I mean, they're just culturally very, very different. And there is, as far as I can tell, you know, zero goodwill between those different factions of Californians.
There's a concept which I like a lot and which we enjoy here in Quebec. It's called a social cohesion. So because Quebecers speak a common language that is different from the majority that surrounds them, which is French, and a lot of the people who are descendants of, there's the majority of people are descended from French settlers. But even those who aren't descended from the French settlers, they speak French, and that creates a sense of national identity which is apart from the rest of Canada or the rest of America. But that also creates a social cohesion. And perhaps you can also experience that in any rural environment where people have to rely on each other to, you know, bring in the hay or stack the wood. There is a bit more of that here. And the two, just like in Catalonia in Spain, the independence movements created sort of forged very strong political bonds. And so that, like, that manifested in the Maple Leaf movement in 2012 when the provincial government tried to seriously increase tuition because our college is very affordable. Like, it's just a few thousand dollars to go to college. But they tried to multiply it three times or so. And the streets were filled during the summer of 2012 and were paralyzed in Montreal to the point that the government did back down and to not allow that. So like we had, you know, something similar to the Occupy movement that actually led to real change. Like they backed down in terms of their desire. So I associate that with social cohesion. And so I think political units where there is that social cohesion function better than these really large units of like hundreds of millions of people. So I think a federated states model, like states of social cohesion that are brought together under a federation, is a model that I prefer, maybe similar to the European Union.
Well, let's bring this to a close, and I'll just invite you to mentally review what we've talked about and see if there's anything you think is important that needs to be made explicit that we didn't really get to.
One of the main things is that, you know, if anybody's thinking about being involved in trading, it's important to realize that losing money is easier than making money. And so it's not something to get into lightly. But that being said, some people with a mathematical mind or who have interested in charts and the finance might find some reward in it. But one has to approach that with caution because it's not like learning Dungeons and Dragons. Like you're playing with fire, which is your own financial future. And that being said, like I think we're in fast times and it's a double-sided coin. And I hope everybody who's listening gets through it well. I'm quite confident that we'll have turned the corner of this whole situation by early June. You know, looking at what happened in China and the infection rates there and South Korea. So I hope that nobody's fear is to the point that they're dealing with too much anxiety, because I don't think that's necessary or helpful.
One last topic. So Bitcoin had been pretty stable for a long time, right around 8,000. And now it's at 5,000. And that's surprising to me because it seemed for a while that Bitcoin was where panicky investors were putting their money.
I expect
Bitcoin to be climbing right now.
The same thing happened with gold. Like the price of gold has tanked and gold is supposed to be, you know, store of value when everything else. So there's some really weirdness there. And There's not a lot of consensus on financial Twitter about that. So Ethereum is like Bitcoin 2.0, but another thing is like it's only like $100 per coin. So like you can actually, and it tracks with Bitcoin. It's sort of like the cool kids Bitcoin. So I think that's a safe bet. Like I would if people get involved in anything, like I think those digital currencies will do better from here. They seem to be on sale for some reason, but as I said earlier, I think the digital economy will do just fine because of all of this. And so I think these are anomalies, which I don't understand why it's happening, but in my opinion, they are just an overreaction to what's happening right now.
Well, here's my closing thought. It seems to me that we are really overreacting in terms of, you know, just the damage that this virus would do if left unchecked. Like, I think if it hadn't ever been identified, you know, demographically, we might have discovered you know, a few months down the line that, you know, there were more flu deaths than expected this year. That's interesting. I wonder what that's about. But if there had never been any news stories about it, not enough people would have been touched by it personally to even notice. But maybe this overreaction is valuable in that it is demonstrating to us, you know, how dependent we are on just-in-time trade links with China, how dependent we are on people being able to get out of their homes and move around, and the reverse, you know, how unnecessary so much of that, you know, moving around really is, particularly in terms of business travel where you're flying across the country or to a different country in order to sit and have a conversation with somebody, which you could totally do over Zoom like we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. Like how much we are dependent on economic activity, which in and of itself is really unnecessary. You know, if it weren't for the fact that everybody needed to be provisioned with money, so much of what we do is really useless. And we can stop doing it with no ill effects other than the fact that people don't have money anymore.
Hear, hear.
All right, well, if there's no argument, Ed, thanks so much.
Thanks for the chat, KMO.
My pleasure. Talk to you again soon.
Yes.
All right, that is all for this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Now, I know you probably expected me to rant and rave here at the end for a while. If you don't regularly check in, go to my YouTube channel. There is more than enough ranting and raving there to satisfy your cravings. And if not, well, you know, there's an inexhaustible supply of other people's ranting and raving there. Some of whom agree with me, others don't. I suggest listening to both. All right. I usually end these things with an invitation for you to communicate with me. That invitation stands. Usually with that invitation comes an acknowledgement that, you know, most of you won't take me up on that, and that that's fine. And it is fine. But for those of you who do provide feedback, you have a lot more leverage than people who don't. And for those who don't, I mean, I've never tried to communicate with Dan Carlin, although I really enjoy his podcasting work. It's all good. But I am curious as to how you're doing. What your experience of this semi-voluntary lockdown is. I say semi-voluntary because, you know, it's different in different places. But as you probably know, the way to get in touch with me is via email, kmo@crealm.com. If you're on Patreon, you can send me a message via Patreon. If you are subscribed through crealm.com, you can post a comment to this episode on crealm.com. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram, although my Instagram presence is mostly devoted to illustration and comic strips. And of course, there is the YouTube channel. And still, if you search for my channel by name, which is out of my head, you won't find me. But if you search for Humans Suck, unfortunately my most popular video, you will find my channel. As you probably know, I don't believe that humans suck. And I wasn't really going for a clickbait title, but I sure hit upon one. Anyway, humans, continue not sucking. Continue looking after yourselves and the people who love you and whom you love. Take care of your immediate local community and continue to pay attention to what's happening via the internet, which is the thing that connects us. I will talk to you again soon. Really, stay well.